This talk was given by Jody Hojin Kimmel Sensei at the Zen Center of New York City. Hojin Sensei is a resident teacher at the monastery and co-director of ZCNYC. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about the temple's retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org/ZCNYC. Thanks for listening.
This is from Gyoji, Ceaseless Practice, or Continuous Practice, by Master Dogen. In the great way of the Buddhas and ancestors, surely there is a supreme ceaseless practice that continues endlessly. There is not the slightest gap between awakening the mind, practice, enlightenment, and nirvana. Ceaseless practice continuously revolves. Therefore, it does not depend on individual powerful acts, nor on the spirit of others. It is undefiled, ceaseless practice. The virtue of ceaseless practice maintains self and others. Essentially, our ceaseless practice fills heaven and earth and influences everything with its virtue. Although we may be unaware of it, it still occurs. I've always loved this fascicle. It's a long one, and there's a lot in it. It's very rich. But this is that thread of turning towards practice, that whether we're aware of it or not is continuously going on. You know, I always wondered, and when it's good, we remember to practice. We're practicing. But when it gets difficult, do we remember that we actually have a practice? And what is it? What is it? What do we actually turn towards? Unaware of it, it still occurs. So aware of it, it's revolving. And its virtue of ceaseless practice maintains self and others. So to awaken is to put light on the darkness. The darkness, what was in the dark suddenly comes into the light. And we all have this experience. But it's not to be viewed as an end point or even a goal, right? Like we awaken or become enlightened and we cross some kind of finish line. You know, turn in your zafu. Achieve something. And there's nothing more for us to see. That's one of the great myths of awakening. That somehow we will become enlightened and we will know absolutely everything. We imagine that the negative emotion will never arise again in our little minds. That will dwell in a hall of bliss permanently and forever. This sounds really good. And maybe just like we thought. But it's very much like having a really good dessert. Imagining that our life would be fantastic if we never had to eat vegetables or fruit again. We could just live on dessert. And this is a myth, that there is an end point, a destination, and there isn't. There's only maybe these relative points of destination, temporary points. The realization of our true nature is the end of not knowing who and what we are. When we awaken, we know we are this infinite presence. You know this. And we can know that it is the end of not knowing who and what we are, but it is not the end in any absolute sense. So it's also a beginning. It's also the beginning. For any of us in this room that has awoken to our true nature, which is probably a majority of us, though you may think it's not so, I do, or you wouldn't be coming back. So something has awoken to your true nature. In some way or another, we know that it may be an end of not knowing who we and what we are, but really the beginning of another mysterious unfolding. That beginning of something without end. So it's important to never think of awakening as a goal-oriented activity, or as, what do they say in kayak, your final destination, your point of arrival. I've, since we did the illuminated journals, one day I was in the dining hall where we have our ox herding pictures, which are the depict the 10 stages of a path of enlightenment. And we only had a few minutes left, and I had a bunch of leaves and stuff. So I made an I did the ox herding pictures in leaves. You know, I just took out glue, and I just started like tearing leaves apart. And you know, they were perfect little oxes. Like oak leaves were like perfect little oxes, and then if you stripped the leaf and just had the vein, it was like the whip, the line. So I just went berserk on this, and I started to study them, and I'm still doing ox herding pictures. I can't stop. Like every moment I have, I'm doing the series, and so when I read them, I'm like, oh yeah. I'm here and then here, and you realize that they're endless, and we could be at many of those stages at different times in our practice. In fact, Dido comments, when we are presented with a map of the terrain, we don't confuse the picture for the reality of the landscape we are walking through. We need to keep this distinction in mind when reading a description of a spiritual journey. A description of a path is not the path itself. No two people experience the same spiritual journey, so we can only speak in general terms about spiritual maturation. A true spiritual journey is beyond time and space, history and culture, guidelines and descriptions. In experience the path, there is no sense of distinct and fixed transitions. However, applying the 10 ox herding pictures to the dynamics of training, superimposing them on our experiences, allows us to talk about the spiritual journey and gives us a perspective on how the whole process works. He says, it seems to me that people train better when they are informed about and clear on what they are doing, especially when the maps are balanced with mysteries. Mystery is at the heart of true religious life. We continue to preserve plenty of space in Zen training for the great mysteries. The spiritual journey is an incredible undertaking of endless adventure, of boundless opening. The 10 ox herding pictures and the poems are signposts. For some people, they are helpful. For others, they become a hindrance. Please don't let them be a hindrance to you. Use them to clarify your path, then let them go. So I don't know if it was this way for you, but when you began practice, or even recently, if you thought, had the thought, you know, I want to be enlightened. I want to get to that point. I want to cross the spiritual finish line. And preferably, I'd like to be in first place, maybe with a big audience, someone that notices. I remember that feeling in competitive swimming. It's like, I would like to be in first place, and maybe with a big audience, someone that notices. It's a funny thing that there are many points where we think we've crossed the finish line. And if we cross any kind of finish line, there's this aha, aha, where we experience directly what's true. And sometimes it feels like it's an end. This is it. Now I've done it. And for a split second, it's as though there's nothing else to realize. Did you ever have that feeling? Oh, now I did it. Done. That's it. Oh my God, it's over. So there's never going to be such a final aha. And then we can really go, ha 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 ha. That's the nature of realization. That's why anybody who ever knew what they were talking about called this truth of being limitless, infinite. Infinite is just a way of saying it never runs out. And I know when I was younger in practice, not so much younger, I thought there's just one big like awakening, like there's just going to be this like big like, okay, I'm going to see it, and that was, and that's it. Like all I needed was that thing to happen, right? And meeting Dogen provided a very different view. He knew inside his bones, practice is continuous. Aha is endless. Endless aha, aha, aha. So if we look at his famous words, to study the Buddha way, to study the Buddha way is to study the path of waking up, of liberation, true liberation. That's to study what the Buddha's way is to study the self. To study the self is then to forget the self. So we study it so we can see what it is, so we can forget it. To forget the self is to be actualized by the myriad things. So if the way we define ourself, that self that he's speaking of, to forget that self, then everything else can come forward. There's nothing in the way of the myriad things being this very body and mind, right? And when actualized by myriad things, your body and mind, as well the body and mind of others, drop away. There's no division between anyone, anything, right? Because the divisions, the concepts that keep us divided are what we create. No trace of enlightenment remains, and this no trace continues endlessly. The only thing that comes to an end is the end of ignorance about our own nature. That comes to an end. That is a great and wonderful ending. Of not knowing who and what we are, this can come to an end. This is what Buddha teaches. Thinking that we are simply this body-mind mechanism, this can come to an end. The realization that within this and around this body-mind mechanism is something that's not conceivable. Call it presence, call it space, call it naturalness. The most we can know is, I am that. I am that. I am that ungraspable. And the more we know this, if somebody asks you, what is it that you are? We don't know what this is, really. We can say, that is. We don't know. That is what this is. I don't know what that is. We just know that it's what we are. We can call it emptiness or consciousness or God or spirit. Still, there's a certain mystery to it all. So Evelyn Underhill in her book on mysticism speaks on the mystic's way of being. And she says, the mystic must overcome all attachment to self and ego, the selfish ego, in order to merge with the great one in, under, behind, and through all things. To do this, the mystics must finally give up the greatest good they have ever known, the powerful attachment to the transcendent pleasures and visions of illumination. You can hear a similarity. Giving them up, all things seem at first to have become ashes. The divine seems to have fled. Union is essentially ineffable, ungraspable. In another place, she writes, after all, it is those who have a deep and real inner life who are best able to deal with the irritating details of outer life. Deliberately seek opportunities for kindness, sympathy, and patience. All things are perceived in the light of charity and hence under the aspect of beauty. For beauty is simply reality seen with the eyes of love. Consciousness isn't a thing. It's not an entity. It's not a little core piece of us. It's that which sees and experiences, and it makes every experience possible. It lights up the world. No consciousness, no experience of the world. So what can we know about nothing? When we see, when we realize we are this great emptiness, this great nothingness, this vastness, this sky, this pregnant nothingness from which everything comes and which everything goes. What can we really know about nothing? We can only know something about something. Like when nothing becomes a flower. Like when nothing becomes a tree. Like when nothing becomes a person. And we pretend we know something. It's a flower. It's orange. It's pink. It's pungent. It's fragrant. It's beautiful. It's ugly. It's dying. It's living. We can know, or we can think we know, something as soon as something comes into form. We can know the texture, or the feel, or the taste, the touch, the sense. The sense of the thing. But we can't know anything ultimately about the unknown, about our true nature. All we can know is it's that which, that we are that. It's that which we are. That we are that. That unknown. This might be a stretch, but you know. You know, you all know that you don't know. But we know a lot of somethings. We can't separate ourselves, but we sure do. We sure do. That's the Evelyn, the union Evelyn Underhill speaks of. It's like she says, our eye cannot look at itself. No matter how hard our eyeball tries to get a look at itself, it can never do it. If we look in the mirror, our eye only gets a surface present impression of itself. A surface impression, looking in the mirror. There's the other 99.9% of that that's not surface. And my mind just went to, I'll divert here a little bit. My mother sent me a letter with a news clipping, like many mothers do. Anything about Buddhism, she cuts out and sends. That's how we relate, you know. So she sends a Surya Das's mother. You know, he's a lama, Lama Surya Das. He was born Jewish. I forget what his name was. Maybe some of you know, Ken something or other. Anyway, somebody interviewed her and said, so how do you feel about your son being a lama, a great lama? And she says, I'm 99.9% happy. I wish he were a dentist. I think my mom would answer something very similar. So we can never objectify the truth out there. Not the ultimate truth. We can't make an object out of it. It's just a display. Just its display. It's just the display as our body, as our mind, a flower, a chair, a cushion, the magical display of things. Because it's so open and unfixed, it can take form. It's free in form. But presence itself, that simple silence, unfathomable intelligence, wisdom, compassion, all arising from nothing. It's actually quite a wonderful discovery when we find out for ourselves at the bottom of our own existence is goodness. It could have been that we all ended up just as rotten tomatoes, because we have that in us too. But at the core, actually, all that was really there was just selfishness, wanting to get everything it could for itself. And that's just what life was or is. It's possible it could turn out that way. But when we come to the core of our being, we find actually that the core of our being, the core of everyone's being, is actually something very beautiful, something very radiant. When we're not caught up in our story, then there's naturally this causeless peace, a causeless wisdom, causeless benevolence, something that allows us to discriminate what's true and what's not true. We are moral. That's low in our belly. We actually do know what is skillful and what is not skillful. We know. We don't always listen. You know, the universe just does its thing. This is the potential. And it's not in our mind anymore. So we don't even really know where it comes from. In our tradition, we call it prajna, heart wisdom, which means the wisdom of the absolute, the wisdom of emptiness, the wisdom before knowing, prajna, the wisdom before knowing, the wisdom that simply knows. That's this awareness, this consciousness, that when we say I see myself do this, I see myself do that, that's prajna. That's wisdom. How would we know? How do we know that? It's fascinating that we can simply discriminate truth from untruth. Spontaneously arising, not a product of discriminatory thoughts. Everybody has this. Everybody has prajna, is prajna. Everybody has the deepest, most profound wisdom. You're everybody. I'm everybody. We all have it. But not many of us utilize it because we get too involved listening to the story. How many times have we heard at the quietest moments, or sometimes in very noisy moments, that little voice that says, don't do that? Have you heard that? Or do that? And we say, that? And we say, yeah, do that. I was thinking about a date. You know, not a fruit, but a date. You go on a date with Mr., Mrs., them, perfect. Or so we thought. I mean, our biological stuff was, the bells were ringing. And something in us afterwards says, don't do that again. Don't do that again. Don't go out again. That very still, small voice. Don't do that. It's not for you. Did we listen? Perhaps we missed that was wisdom of the universe. Did we recognize it? Did we know that was the enlightened Buddha nature, prajna, giving us a gift of grace? The beauty of truth is that truth never insists. So we might hear it, but we might not pay attention. We might override it. This is the beauty of truth. When it comes to us from the inside, it's a truth that is known, but it does not insist. Right? That's why we can throw the truth away so effortlessly, easily. We cannot listen to it. Truth doesn't care. Reality, it's going to get its way. How many of us have said before our altar or put our hands in prayer, I want the truth. Please give me the truth. And then it comes, but it's not in the package we wanted. It's like, what? Something comes and it's difficult, or it's like a slammer, and we're like, wait a minute, I asked for the truth. No, not this. This can't be it. What a delivery. I asked very deeply and personally to show me the truth. What's this that's coming in? And it comes in a package, but it's not up to us. We do, I think the Rolling Stones had it. We can't always get what we want, but we do get what we need. We may know all along what is true because we heard it from silence a few times. And we just might say, ah, forget it. Forget it. I'm just going to do whatever. And we ignore the signals. Sometimes the universe is loud. Like my brother, he gets slammed by the universe. It's so loud. Like, it's like a 2x4 for him. Some people have that karma where they just get so hit. Like, so he lost a child. It was 5 months old. And he and his partner, his wife at the time, you know, I wasn't that close to him at that time, but they needed help. And everyone kept saying to him, just go get some help. Like, it's so easy to just talk to someone. This has happened to so many people. Join a group of people that this has happened to for support. Don't be alone in this. Yeah. Everyone's grace was just, you know, you can't do much more. So one day he's driving along, and it seems like a made-up story, but he sees a playground, and he's driving, and of course his mind wanders into this child again, and somebody was turning into their driveway, so he rear-ends them hard because they're turning. He didn't see a thing. Bam! Whole thing stops. Gets out of the car, and he starts talking fast. He said, "Sorry, I wasn't paying attention. I lost my child, and I saw the playground, and I got carried away, and I just wasn't here. I'm sorry. It's my fault." And he said the guy just took him in, and he said, "I am a specialist for people grieving for the loss of a child. You don't have to pay me a cent if you come into therapy." Can it be any more direct? And I said to my brother, "What did you say?" He said, "I will." And he did. And it saved him. His wife did not go. They were both invited. And that's not the first time he's gotten like deliveries like that. And some of us do, and sometimes it's much more subtle. So we really have to listen, and when that voice comes, to say, "What? What? What was that? I'm listening. What? What? What's true? What do I do? How do I proceed? But wait a minute, I'm so excited about this, but something else is giving me another signal." So just to pay attention. All that this means is it might take a month, a year, 10 years for truth to come through. So that's why practice is continuous, because it's not like a thing that we can like give it to me. It's open, but we have to learn it in a way. We have to see it. It's like those old Midas commercials. Pay us now, pay us later. There's no escape. Harmony is always what wants to restore itself. There's no escape from our own good sense. Then years looking back, we might say, "I knew it. I knew it. Did you ever say that? All the signs were there. I knew it. I knew it that there was something, trouble, that something was off in the very thing I was doing." In our own way, everybody is graced with moments of wisdom, simple moments of wisdom. Very simple moments, gifts, because it's always functioning. Of course, we have to be out of our story. That's why we do this, so we can learn the difference, get out of it, so we can receive that. We must value the gift of grace more than we value the surface wants and demands of our egoic personality, says Evelyn. It must be valued, these moments of wisdom, not to be ignored. And then there's the deepest, deepest wisdom, transcendent wisdom. And it does begin with intuitive awakening of wisdom itself that lets us know from the inside, intuitively and authentically. what we really are wakes up from the mind structure, from the little me. Remembering this is not an end, it's just the end of ignorance of our true nature. It's the beginning, it's just the beginning of discovering what it means to live. And that is what we realize. I'll end with a quote from Suzuki Roshi from Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, on his informal talk on Zen meditation and practice. While you are continuing this practice week after week, year after year, your experience will become deeper and deeper, and your experience will cover everything you do in your everyday life. The most important thing is to forget all gaining ideas, all dualistic ideas. In other words, just practice Zazen in a certain posture. Do not think about anything. Just remain on your cushion without expecting anything. Then eventually you will resume your own true nature. That is to say, your own true nature resumes itself. So I encourage you to bring the spirit of continuous practice into your hearts, that our everyday life is the medium of our awakening. And that this, what we're doing right now, is the real sutra. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JizoProject.